Tonight on Arena, a bumper crop of Christmas film releases, including Nosferatu, The Nickel Boys and Mufasa the Lion King, and we preview Robbie Williams as a CGI monkey in Better Man. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and indeed you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. We really do have a bumper edition of film reviews for you this evening. Five movies, no less, that will be released over the Christmas and New Year period for the sake of fairness. We are going to go in order of release. Opening tomorrow is Mufasa the Lion King, a prequel to the much-loved and much-rewarded Lion King. Up next is The Order, starring Jude Law and Nicholas Holt, a drama about an FBI man's pursuit of far-right extremists. We Live in Time is directed by John Crowley, our very own John Crowley, and stars Andrew Garfield and Florence Pugh as a couple, Tobias and Almut, who must face the challenges of ill health at a very young age. Robert Eggers brings us his version of the vampire classic Nosferatu, starry cast and a grotesque aesthetic. And finally this evening, we'll be looking at the screen adaptation of Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Nickel Boys. Gemma Cray and Justin McGregor have been to the movies and they are with me in studio this evening. It really is a lot. But I suppose it's that time of year, isn't it, where you're going to want to choose the one that you're going to go into. And we're going to advise you to choose wisely, I think, is what I'm picking up from both Justin and Gemma on this one. Let us start with The Lion King. I don't know why you'd want to do anything with The Lion King. Let's put that to the one side just for the moment. What story are we getting here in this version or this story of The Lion King?
Well, of course, The Lion King was about Simba and his kind of coming of age story based around this young lion cub, and it was traditional animation. So this is about his father, Mufasa, and him at that same age that we kind of meet Simba in The Lion King, and how he and Scar, who we know, you know, is his brother who wants to take over the kingdom,
Simba's
the world.
Uncle. Yeah,
Simba's uncle who wants to overtake, you know, the pride, the pride world in the original Lion King. It's their origin story of both of them. But it's done photorealistically. So it's done very much to the standard of, you know, Planet Earth, you know, in terms of its CGI.
Yeah, and of course, if it is, we can get into his philosophical argument as to whether it's realism to have lions speaking. But it's certainly photorealism, and this follows up from, it was 2019 when we got the actual original Lion King story in this photorealism version, Gemma.
So it's the same writer, that was directed by Jon Favreau. This is Barry Jenkins, who we all know from Moonlight, so it's a very different direction for him to take. But I think very much so he seems to have bring a kind of a cohort of actors from strong emotional indie films along with him to the cast, which are pretty decent and powerful. I think we will agree to slightly disagree, but like it delivers what it says on the tin. It sets all the pieces up quite nicely. It doesn't do as much twisting or intrigue as, say, Wicked would, in terms of, you know, a prequel that is adjacent to some very familiar IP that we all know and enjoy so well.
Right. It is a prequel to The Lion King that we all love and know and enjoy and have enjoyed so well. It starts out with this kind of framing device, which looks like an excuse to have Seth Rogen and Billy Eichner back on the tiles. The grandfather is telling the story here. Is that how it's been? Oh, no, it's not the grandfather.
It's the mandrill, Rafiki, is telling the story to Kiara, who is Simba's daughter, and they've gone off to
she's the granddaughter of Mufasa,
and Simba and his wife have gone off to give birth in the birthing lands and left her alone during a really bad thunderstorm, and she's taken refuge in Rafiki's cave with Seth Rogen's Pumbaa and Billy Eichner's Timon to act a little, I guess what they would call in sports, color commentary, a little bit of humor, strangely without really any jokes, but that's sort of the setup of the story, and that's what framed it. So we come back and forth, I think, four or five times throughout.
Yeah, every so often they do the Statler and Waldorf kind of commentary on the story so far, as it were. Let's hear them being quite annoyed that they're not part of the tale here. Pumbaa the Hog, voiced by Seth Rogen, and Billy Eichner as Timon.
So just to be clear, we're not in this story.
It feels a little bit like Heroes is stealing my thunder here.
Yeah, you know, I don't feel seen.
No, there's a lot of stories with all of us. Tell one of those.
Can I make one small suggestion? Less childhood drama, more meerkat.
Rafiki, I know who Topka's gonna be.
Oh, me too. It's so obvious. But maybe just so we're on the same page, tell me, is it Simba?
Oh. Is it me?
Pumbaa.
Am I your bossy? That makes no sense. But seriously, I have one question. Am I Taka?
Yes, you are talking. Billy Eichner's time and Seth Rogen as Pumbaa there in a scene from Mufasa, the Lion King. And that really is a framing device, and they keep coming back to it as a way of getting Seth Rogen and Eichner in there, I think. But the main story that we get here, it's even kind of a misnomer to say it's Mufasa. It's really the story of the nasty uncle, Scar. It's his origin story that we get in many ways, isn't it, Gemma?
In many ways, he's a shadow character. So Mufasa, like at the very beginning, he's lost from his original pride. He's taken in by Taka, who becomes Scar's father, Obasi. He's a very hierarchical leader in his pride. He's very apprehensive about letting people that are outside the pride and strangers in, thinking that there's a lot of danger there. So, you know, there's that kind of very obvious commentary within the politics of these different lion groups and how they exist, and they've quite strong identity. But anyway, needless to say, Taka manages to convince his dad. Mufasa is sort of relegated to live with the women, so he grows up hunting and develops all these kind of talents and skills and ability, and learns humility and how to deal with women, while Taka grows up entitled and, you know, being told he's going to inherit the kingdom. And between them, those two identities, although they start off as peers, once Taka has the other, that kind of higher hand, he's happy in that space. But when Mufasa begins to come into his own as they grow up, that's when the real issue
And Taka, starts. I suppose, for the ease, most people will know Scar from The Lion King. So Taka is eventually, he gets a scar in a fight, and of course he's saving Mufasa, and that's how he gets the scar, and that's how he gets the name. Does it explain that origin? Does it get convoluted as it starts to get into the whys and wherefores of all of that, Justin?
It's pretty convoluted. I can't tell whether it's just way too linear or it's actually madly fragmented.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it has a clear plan to it. And it certainly feels around the middle of the film. I was trying to work out when the singing stopped. And it seems like in the second half of the film, there were no more songs. And it was almost like everyone was just like, let's get to the end of this journey, the way the characters were just trying to get to the end of this journey.
Because just like The Lion King, it is a musical film. And the music here, Lin-Manuel, whose name has gone out of my head, of Hamilton fame, is Miranda, whose name of Hamilton. He has given us this music. Is it as good as the original music? Is it as good as the original lyrics?
There wasn't any memorable bangers in there that you're going to, you know, that the kids are going to want to stick on repeat. There's a few nice moments. There's a few lovely songs. There's you know, like everything is upbeat, but almost to a fault, where the songs are quite incongruent a lot of the time to what's happening on screen. You know, you'll have like one of the villain lines gleefully singing, but it's such a upbeat tempo, it doesn't fit quite well.
Yeah.
And the other thing we should remember here, because you've mentioned, you know, you were saying there about the kids might want to hum along. I guess this is for the family, the potential family audience, but be ready for the younger children to nod off, I would suggest.
No, I think they would. Like, it's not, there's bits of excitement, but there's not a lot of excitement.
But just the
there's
length bits, of the duration.
And really, really long. Yeah, it really feels like a, you know, it's a journey film, right? Mufasa is lost and he's trying to get to this sort of promised land with Taka with him. And it just feels like a very long, slow journey. They talk a lot about food, but we never see anybody eat. There's just sort of this, it's just weird, I think, in a lot of ways. And not the least of which is photorealistic singing lions absolutely blew my mind. I didn't know what I was looking at. Like, talk about being taken out of a film. It did me in. It would be like if in Planet Earth. Like,
so let me get it straight. You were okay with photorealistic lions talking but not singing.
I could. There's enough history of that from Mr. Head, you know, the talking horse, that I could just get by with that. But when it broke into songs, I just flashed back to cats, which is not a good flashback.
And yet it's so less weird than mermaids. like how the physics work of singing mermaids, I have no understanding. And when they're photorealistic, that it's very unnerving, because that's
again, I would caution to say photorealism and mermaids, peculiar kind of oxymoron, that one. Does it work overall, Gemma? And would you recommend it as a family movie over the Christmas period?
I didn't think it was terrible. I thought there was lots to enjoy. There's visual spectacles. I thought the score and the scope of it was very beautiful. The landscapes, the animation was nice. I mean, there was still nice moments. It teased. If you were a fan of the lore, there's a lot of little Easter eggs and beats in there. Mm. So I mean, I would still, like, it's going to be cold. It's going to be a long January. I'd say 3.5.
Okay, Justin, I don't think, you're not as feeling as generous as all of that.
No, you know, coming, as I said, I didn't see the photorealistic Lion King. You know, there's the Lion King 1.5, the Lion King 2, there's the 2 spin-off TV shows. It just feels like another link in a cash chain. And, you know, I really, as a film with no sentimental tie to the Lion King, I would give it 1 stars. But I think a family who's a big fan, like, yeah, maybe they'll get to 2.5, you know.
Yeah, well, I suppose if you know the original Lion King, it would be interesting to see the origin story, albeit with photorealism and singing lions. Okay, I'm not sure what to make of that one. Let's move on to The Order. This is a film starring Jude Law, playing a character called Terry Husk, an FBI agent who has moved from chasing down organized crime in New York to what he hopes will be a slower pace and an easier way of life in Idaho. No, it's not going to be, because the robberies that he's investigating there have a much more sinister motive behind them than originally thought. You've seen this one, Justin, and this is, there's a basis in truth in this. It's based on a true story. Who or what, where or are the Order?
Yeah, so we're in Idaho and the Pacific Northwest around Washington State, sort of September-ish 1983 to December 1984. That was the time frame of the real rise of the Order. So the Order was a splinter group of, you know, kind of Aryan Nation, Aryan Brotherhood, a white supremacist group, which they deal with. And it was based on a book which was done by two journalists about the real crimes called the Silent Brotherhood,
yeah,
who were also known as the Order. So they've taken that sort of as their take. But instead of, I mean, obviously that is a huge topic and a really difficult topic, but it's really fascinating how Justin Kurtzel has approached the material, the director, because while we have these amazing bank robberies and they're really frenetic, they're really very short. The drama and the tension is really in getting to know both sides of the story. And we actually get to see Nicholas Holt's Bob Matthews, who's formed this splinter group.
So he's the white supremacist.
He's the white supremacist. We see him, first of all, splintering away in a church. He stands up and he gives a speech that's just very positive and upbeat, because it doesn't mention any of the harsh realities of, you know, white supremacism and the violence that they're going to use to achieve these goals. And it's done very, I wouldn't say sympathetically, but it's done very realistically about them. They're not sprouting some horrible hate the way maybe American History X does. It's all very kind of realistic and natural, and it makes it all the more horrifying.
When he talks about what he wants people who are going to join into his group doing, he said, well, we're going to recruit, we're going to train, we're going to fundraise. Then we get into assassination and eventually large-scale domestic terrorism acts. So, you know, it kind of moves from fairly ordinary things into a pretty violent place quite quickly. So what's the dynamic here with Jude Law?
So Jude Law was an FBI agent. He was in New York. He was dealing with organized crime. His last case had gone sort of horribly wrong and an informant had been killed. And he's gone to Idaho to slow down. Mm. He's separated from his wife and daughters. He really wants them to come out and reunite. He starts hunting and fishing. But at first he thinks these are only bank robberies, and it's actually a young police officer convinces him that actually there's more going on here, and he's built a case file, and he begins to realize that actually this is much more deep. You know, this is a domestic terrorism case, sort of the first major one of its kind in the 20th century in America.
Bob Matthews is the character played by Nicholas Holt, who then the Jude Law character is investigating and following. Let's listen to Holt as Bob Matthews. And he's setting out his manifesto in this clip. A bit of language towards the end.
Hey, Bob, I got the truck outside. What is this?
Declaration of war.
Who am I sending to?
Congress, House of Representatives, White House, New York Times, Denver News. Everyone.
What?
It's happening. The war has begun.
Fuck, there's no fucking army. Everybody's gone.
Cattle die. K kinsmen die, I too shall die. But the one thing that I know that never dies is the fame of a dead man's deeds.
Quite a chilling Nicholas Holt there in a scene from The Order. He carries this off with to great effect, Justin.
No, I mean, I think doing it so understatedly, doing it so casually, makes it so much more horrifying than if you actually tried to make it horrible. Because what they're dealing with and what they're discussing is the death of all non-whites, the death of all Jewish people in America. Like, that's the last stage of the book that is inspiring them, which is called The Turner Diaries, is called The Day of the Rope. And that's what they're moving towards, this day when all the enemies, you know, domestic enemies and traitors get hung, ideally in front of, you know, in front of Congress. And it's really chilling, especially because the Turner Diaries, that this book that appears within this film, was used by the January 6 attackers also as a guide to what they needed to do.
Yeah, they make a reference to that, I think, in the is there a postscript up on the screen?
But
surely anybody watching it would know this is a reference to today as much as it is a reference to back then, whatever it was it the 70s?
83. Yeah. No, I definitely think so. Like, it's really hard not to watch it, because the way they do the clothes is it's very period, certainly more in the cars, but there are times you forget that it's 1983. And it's really very clever the way that, you know, a lot of the fashion that they're wearing is fashion we still wear today. And it just kind of nicely sets you up.
Justin Carzel is the director here. He is Justin Carzel as well. Like yourself. What is the nature of his filmmaking style, and how suitable is it to this? I mean, we're talking about the man who gave us the true history of the Kelly Gang, the Peter Carey novel, and Assassin's Creed. So quite a broad range of styles.
I'd say this is more like the true history of the Kelly Gang, especially in how that film used Australia as a kind of backdrop to this, you know, this beautiful backdrop to this human violence happening in front of it. And in this case, with cinematographer Adam Arkapaw, it's Idaho and the Pacific Northwest. And it's stunning and it's lush and it's beautiful. But the cars driving through it are filled with this hate and this kind of pending horror.
So worth seeing. A dark theme over the Christmas period, but maybe one if you want to kind of get your...
It's done well. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't go into the material in a way that I think would make it, you know, really difficult to watch. It does it in a really, really interesting way. For me, it was a very easy 5 stars. It's a really good film.
So it's the banality that becomes the most evil, I guess.
The banality is so intense.
you know,
it's quite remarkable.
Right, let's move on then to We Live in Time, which is due for release actually on January the 1st, 2025. Illness and romance combine in We Live in Time. Story is Tobias, played by Andrew Garfield, Almut, played by Florence Pugh, a couple who meet, get married and have a child and work their way through Almut's cancer diagnosis, told through 4 distinct timelines. And as I say that, I think, is this very confusing? I should say it's directed by John Crowley. 4 distinct timelines sounds as if, where's the story going to bring me here? But seemingly not when you're watching, Gemma.
It kind of tells the arc and unfurls their story. And I think very much so in a way that memory works, where you recall something and then it's linked to something else and it plays it like that. And it does play with that premise. So like that, we don't start off with their meeting and have it build from there. We start off with these kind of like small moments where they're going to hospital, and maybe they're going to hospital because they're giving birth, but they're actually going to hospital for a cancer diagnosis and then giving birth. Then we kind of take steps back into their earlier relationship and learn more about like who they are as people, like when the stakes are already high, so you're really invested from the get-go. And they have one of their first big fights is about how she doesn't want children, and one of the key moments is how he decides to support her in that. And then when she gets her cancer diagnosis the first time around, she decides to take the more riskier option that, you know, means the cancer can come back, to save part of her reproductive organs so that she can have kids, because it's something that they want to do together, because the relationship has built. And it reveals all those key moments and these beautiful points that are so relevant and kind of builds up to the crescendo of who they are.
It's because it's not a straight narrative arc, you sometimes, you know, the decision that they've made later on, and I guess that would make it very moving at certain points along the way, because you know where it's heading. Let's have a listen to a clip, and this is the moment when they meet. We'll be a little bit linear about it, or certainly shortly after they meet, because there was a little bit of a car crash involved, a running over, in fact. Florence Pugh as Almut and Andrew Garfield as Tobias, looking across a hospital corridor at each other. And Tobias certainly is wondering, who are you and what am I doing here?
They needed the bed back.
What's happened to my underwear?
Oh, I literally have no idea. This was all you... all you had on you. The chocolate orange was pronounced dead at the scene. I'm Almut, by the way.
Almut?
Almut.
Tobias. So sorry, but do we know each other?
Oh, yeah, no. Sorry. I ran you over. Sorry.
Sorry.
There you go. That is Andrew Garfield as Tobias and Florence Pugh as Almut in a scene from We Live in Time. And as I was saying as we were listening to that, of course, we see the meet cute moment late or further into the film, so we know all the other stuff. We know that she's very ill. We know about the child that they have, all of those things. So it changes how you view that. And it made me wonder, Justin, do you feel you're looking at a romantic comedy, a rom-com here? Or are you looking at a dramedy? What are you watching?
I think it's very, very clever that it's kind of neither. You know, it takes a lot of the tropes and the things you would expect from, a romantic comedy. Like, for instance, the end of Act Two, we get to see a big fight. But instead of it leading to some artificial breakup and a reunion later in the film, they actually resolve the fight like the way that a couple would. So it kind of takes these moments and takes them slightly in different directions and then goes back to, you know, the other form and then kind of comes back to the romantic comedy. So it's really, really clever. And it's a lot more the way people tell a story, where you're telling someone a story and you're like, oh, wait, I didn't tell you how they bought the house. Yeah, and then you tell them how they bought the house. And then now I get that joke.
Yes,
like, it's really clever. So, yes, it's not like watching Memento and you're really thinking it through and watching time flow backwards. It just actually makes a lot of sense, but it makes those moments more impactful and more rich being where they are.
Which has a lot to the screen adaptation here, Nick Payne, who gave us that, and John Crowley, the director, that they've managed to hold that way of telling the story, Gemma.
Yeah, and again, the tension and what's at stake is constantly rising. So a big issue for her is when she gets the first news of her second diagnosis and what this means, knowing how difficult it was to recover the first time, she poses the really important question where she suggests to him, what if we don't treat this? The odds aren't brilliant. What if we don't treat this and we enjoy the time that we have left and make it have meaning? And I think that's ultimately the core of what this
film
is.
We live in time.
Yeah.
And everybody talking about the two leads here, Garfield and Pugh, huge chemistry between the two of them.
Amazing chemistry. I mean, you know, in the best rom-coms, you feel like the people really are falling in love. And this, I think you and the audience fall in love with them as a couple. Like, you really want to know them. I mean, she definitely has more dialogue than him, but his reactions and his non-verbal, you know, pain and the sadness of what he's going through is really clear on screen. Like, it really is an amazing combination of her being the more chatty one, you know, him being the bit more the keep calm and carry on. But we really know what's going on. You know, their emotions are just there for us.
And we also get her career as a chef is there in the background as well, a part of the story. And we should mention Sky, her second in command, played by the Ciarán Hinds' daughter, Aoife.
Yes, so she's amazing in this. One of the things that Almut decides that she wants to do when she gets the second diagnosis and really struggles with it is compete in the World Chef's competition, this very prestigious, very, very high stakes competitive competition. And when she recruits Skye to help her while she's sick, and it's a physically grueling something where you have to be on your game, you have to be like even prepping for it is almost like a marathon every single day, that she decides to take this on in a way that, you know, that's going to take time away from her with her daughter. That's going to really impact her treatments and her physical health.
Right. So I'm wondering if it's a kind of a date movie, possibly over Christmas. You will cry, I'm suggesting, even as you've described it to be. Yeah. Stars from you, Gemma, first of all?
4.5. I thought it was
four
brilliant.
4 to 4.5. And Justin?
Oh, no, it's a definite date movie, but it's a mature date movie. It's not a silly date movie. It's a really one you're going to go and you're going to actually have serious conversations after watching. I gave it 4.5 stars. It just sits with you. It does make you think about your own place in time, which is amazing.
All right. Okay. Sounds very interesting indeed. And for release on January the 1st. Okay. We've done 3 of our 5 movies. We'll be back with the other 2 after these. Okay, still with me, Gemma Cray, and Justin McGregor, who have been speaking about our first 3 films we released over the Christmas period. Next one you have seen, Gemma. Don't think you're too happy, funnily enough. Nosferatu. This is the Robert Eggers version, the man behind films like The Witch and The Lighthouse. So he seems as if he's the perfect candidate to give us Nosferatu. Do we need another Nosferatu? I mean, obviously this is the kind of Dracula story that we've seen a million times. But we have also seen one Nosferatu from Wim Wenders, and of course the original from W.M. Marrow back in the whatevers, the 20s, wasn't it?
Yeah, and given his past like body of work, he has a lot of period pieces. Everything is very, he was a production designer. Everything is so brilliantly like visceral and textural and experimental. Like he should have been the perfect person to do this, and I think maybe he creates that, but he certainly this was not an enjoyable watch from beginning, middle, and end.
There's not even a quote there. This was not an enjoyable watch, beginning, middle, and end. So the basic setup here is young couple, they're very happily married, they go off and they find out that perhaps the evil vampire has eyes on the wife.
It's the 1830s. It's Lily Rose Depp. Her character, Ellen Hutter, has just gotten married to Thomas Hutter, played by Nicholas Holt, who I would rather watch him in the other film. I mean, again, you have a brilliant cast. There's Aaron Taylor Johnson, Emma Corrin. They're great performers. And they're like a cast. I mean, this couple have just gotten married and she has a dark secret. When she was really, really young, she prayed for her guardian angel. And instead, what she got was Count Orlok.
Who's effectively the vampire of the story.
who's this bad guy. He speaks to her. He controls her. He's constantly calling her to him. But
played
now,
by Bill Skarsgård in this version.
Yes, and he exists as a disembodied voice and he can control her and she's hypnotized by him. And this has been something that she has brought on herself since she was a very young age. But now that she's married to Thomas, who's like a real estate agent, all of a sudden now, Count Orlok decides that he's going to call in the chips and he wants her to be his bride and he's going to do anything
looking
in his power to
looking for
to
her
do it.
Soul at this point in time. It's payback time. Let's listen to Lily Rose Depp in this scene where she's basically referring to a supernatural experience.
Standing before me, all in black, was death. But I was so happy. So very happy. We exchanged vows, we embraced, and when we turned around, everyone was dead. Father and everyone. The stench of their bodies was horrible. But I'd never been so happy.
That's Lily Rose Depp as Ellen Hutter in scene from Nosferatu. Is there any attempt to give some sort of 21st sensibility to the story here? Because obviously, you know, the male gaze on the female is very common in these vampire films.
Oh, yes. And the metaphor as well for that, like, not necessarily consensual penetration is very clear. And it really stands through to this where, you know, like he's targeting her. He's targeted her since she was a child. Like that metaphor really, and the darkness of it is very much so prevalent here and clear. But what is really, I found the most unpleasant thing about the whole film is not just that it was boring, is that actually it ogles her. Like, there's not a beat where, you know, where, like, they have her topless for so many unnecessary scenes. There's one scene where she's having a fit and she writhes so sensually, and she's wearing a see-through, like a completely see-through top, and the camera just sits on her torso as one of the professor characters, kind of like he's examining her, so he sort of feels her up.
William Dafoe is one of those professor type characters, isn't he?
And he's sort of, you know, the spiritual guider who gives exposition and goes, you know, this is a bad guy. He's and, like, you know, so, kind of explains it all.
What do you mean? Some of what you're saying there sounds as if it's an interesting film, and certainly I have read praise for Lily Rose Depp.
Yeah, she is good, but the issue with the performances is all these are brilliant characters. It's that they start at 11, the threat is there from the get-go. There's nowhere for them to go but up, because and as a result the performances aren't nuanced and kind of theatrical. Like, even in that clip that you played, like, they're all brilliant, but in this it just feels like it's so overly heightened.
Anything to recommend it, and what are you saying stars wise?
Zero stars. I found the whole thing like a chore to sit through, really unpleasant. There's one scene where a man, and this is like to give someone, he assaults his dead wife, and I just found the whole thing so unpleasant.
Okay. So you're not, there's no recommendation for Nosferatu coming from you, that's clear, Gemma. Let us move on then to Nicol Boyle's Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer Prize winning novel from 2020. Action revolves around a Florida reform school in the Jim Crow era of the 1960s. The boys in the title are Elwood Curtis and Jack Turner, two very different youngsters who meet at the Nicol Academy. This is a great story. It certainly was a very successful book, Justin.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm Colson Whitehead is one of only four writers to win the Pulitzer Prize twice. So obviously the story is at a very, very high level. It's based on a real reform school here. It's called Nicol Academy. It was the Dozier was the name of the real school. And it kind of blends this perspective of what it was like to be in the school from Elwood and Jack's point of view with a story set in the 21st century, where one of the older characters is actually investigating, you know, and finding out what they discovered about the school after it had shut down. So it has these two timelines, you know, sort of going on. But it's the POV that's sort of the point of view really interesting, because the camera book is either Elwood or Jack, and we literally, you know, are seeing the world through their eyes. And they kind of hand off the point of view to each other at various points in the film. So the actors are acting like straight to camera, which is not an easy thing to do, but they totally pull it off. I mean, it's something the director, Ramel Ross, he did it in a documentary, you know, to try and give people a feel of what a Southern black town was like. And he's taken the chance, really, of trying it in a narrative feature film.
And there's two characters here. Elwood, obviously both characters, Elwood and Turner, isn't it, are played kind of younger and older. Elwood, first of all, played by two Ethans, actually, just to confuse matters. Is it mostly with the older guy that we spend our time? Ethan, which of them is it that is the older guy?
Ethan Harris. The older chap. And my thing is actually the youngest performer. We see so little of him just in reflections, because at that point in time the story is told only from his point of view. So we might catch a glimpse of him in a mirror or reflected on a TV screen.
And what about those performers and Brandon Wilson then as the Jack character, isn't it? What's the dynamic between the two of them?
So Elwood is an inspirational, bright, exceptional child. His teacher, Mr. Hill, played by Jimmy Falls, is, you know, sending him to this prestigious school. He's loved by his grandmother. He wants to become an activist. You see him like being hopeful about the future and the civil rights movement and, you know, feeling that things can change. But then, unfortunately, as he's on the way to his first day of this promising new education, he gets into the wrong car with the wrong guy and gets picked up by the police. And as a juvenile, he's tried and he's sent to Nicol Academy, which is where he meets Turner, who's another inmate, another child who's being kind of held there. And Turner again is a smart, bright child, but he fundamentally knows the system is broken and is very cynical about what can be achieved and the way the world exists. And the pair of them are a little bit distant at first, but really become fast friends.
Is the redemption at the end of this, is it an uplifting? I mean, because they're clearly in a very difficult situation, not just in terms of the place that they are, but the Jim Crow laws of the era as well. Is the redemption at the end of this, Justin?
It's a very, there's a redemption, but it's so painfully got. It's so painfully achieved by Elwood. I'll say by Elwood at the end, because there's a bit of a twist I don't want to give away. But there is a redemption. There's a scene right at the end set in the present day, which is, as I say, the early 21st century, where he's in a bar having a drink and a guy comes in and it's one of the former students, you know, who recognizes him. And it's just the pain of what that experience has done to their whole lives. You know, the school being shut down, it's a victory and it's not a victory at all. You know, it's great that the school is shut, but for them, it's, you know, one's unemployed, the other has a business, but, you know, he's lost his wife, you know, and it's all because of this traumatic childhood that they were raised in.
Despite all of that, is it a worthwhile watch?
I think it's really interesting, and it's interesting because Colson Whitehead said, you know, the two characters, he oscillates between optimism and pessimism, you know, and his optimism that we can change the world and make it better, and his pessimism that, you know, America, in his words, is founded on genocide and racism and there's no hope. And he split his personality into these two characters, and it's just a fascinating way to approach his own feelings of being a Black American.
Stars from you on this one, Justin, to start out.
Four and a half. I mean, on one hand, it's a very hard film to criticize because its subject matter is so overwhelmingly amazing. But I'd say 4.5 stars. Very, very worth seeing.
Well, I actually think the form plays such a big part in why this film is so powerful. It shocks you out of to the expected narrative because, I mean, we've seen these types of stories before, but how this plays out.
And we have Ramel Ross to mention, the director, who has decided in this point of view directly at the other character.
And it's amazing how you perceive it differently, how you understand it differently, and it hits just that bit harder. And the performances, again, are just so understated and powerful. You can feel that pain. And it's so jarring when it's directed straight at you. So I actually thought this was the best film I've seen in a long time, and I give it 5.
Solid 5. So from 0 to 5 across 2 films. There you go, Gemma. That's Gemma Cray and Justin McGregor. Thanks to both of you for that, and happy Christmas to both of you as well. Mufasa the Lion King opens tomorrow. The Order goes into cinemas on Friday, December the 27th. We Live in Time opens on January the 1st, and Nosferatu and the Nickel Boys go into cinemas on January the 3rd, 2025. Better Man is a semi-biographical film about Robbie Williams. It's directed by Michael Gracey of The Greatest Showman and Rocketman fame, and it takes a creative swing. Robbie, through every stage of his life, is portrayed as a CGI monkey. The film doesn't follow the usual biopic formula, it opting instead for a surreal dive into the life of a larger-than-life figure himself, from his boy band beginnings in Take That to his tumultuous solo career marred by addiction, fame and family struggles. Better Man blends all of that, humour, darkness and music all present. Delighted that Louise Bruton is in studio with me this evening. She has been watching Better Man. I saw an interview about this. I thought, they're joking now. Robbie Williams as a CGI monkey. And no, up it came on the screen. Robbie Williams as a CGI monkey. Tell us how that works. Michael Gracey, of course, the director here, I think was responsible for the idea, Louise.
So if anybody is familiar with The Greatest Showman or Rocketman, they know that it's a spectacle. And the same can be said for Better Man. And once you get over the gripe, if gripe is the right word, that Robbie is a monkey in this. Nobody else is a monkey. Everybody else is 100% human. There might be some other CGI effects, but he's the only CGI character. It's very easy to settle into the world of this. And Robbie, along with Gracey, have been interviewed together, kind of discussing the reason for this. Mm. And part of it is that Robbie says that his story alone maybe isn't interesting enough to hook people in. It's a very classic rags to riches story, kind of young boy wants to be somebody and he becomes somebody too quick. But by having this stunt, I guess, is a good way to describe it, gets people interested, but it also will help him translate to audiences he didn't reach before as a pop star. He never made it in America, but the movie is getting an American release, and people will go see it because they want to see what's the deal with this monkey.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the recent one that had the Lego Men in it, the recent documentary film, which you're going to be able to listen to this clip. This is a section from the trailer to Better Man. And if you think of Robbie Williams, a performing monkey, perhaps that's what he's getting at here, but also, you know, the kind of cheeky chappy thing is obviously a reference to monkey as well. This will give you a sense of just how the story moves along with Better Man. A lot of strong language, particularly towards the end of this clip.
This is my story, but I'm not going to tell it in an ordinary way because I don't see myself how others see me.
For the next 2 hours, your ass is mine!
To be honest, I've always been a little less evolved.
I don't want to ride.
So let's take it from the top, shall we?
I sit and wait.
My dad was well enamored by the stars of the day.
You can't learn it. You're either born with it or you're a nobody.
There's an angel.
Don't want to be a nobody.
Contemplate my fate.
You're enough.
The places where we go when we're gray and old.
You got in? You're in that band?
I'll get this fucking baby!
Shut up, you tits!
Oh, fuck off, Glenn!
Mother!
Delightful. Better Man there, a bit from the trailer, the Michael Gracie film about Robbie Williams that Louise Bruton is speaking to us about this evening. Just to clarify how it, because I wondered, is it Robbie Williams who was in doing all of this and then the CGI'd the monkey's face onto him? How does it work, Louise, in terms of how the film is actually told? We heard Robbie Williams' voice there as narrator, obviously.
So Robbie, the real human pop star, acts as the narrator. He's overlooking this life, his life, and telling us what's going on internally. But the monkey is voiced by John O'Davies, and he's also motion captured by him. So he would have been kind of filmed with green screen and then transformed into a monkey. So Robbie is there to almost provide comic relief, explaining what's happening in certain moments. Say when he first auditions for Take That, he's kind of telling everybody what's going on in his head and why he did what he did.
Because, and do we get the Take That band? Are they
the
all
Take
there?
The Take That band are in it, and the way that they were casted is absolutely brilliant. You know immediately who is meant to be who. You know who Mark Owen is, and Gary Barlow's first arrival onto the scene is one of the best arrivals I think I've seen.
Jake Simmons is the guy who's playing Gary Barlow in this.
It's fantastic, and it really captures that absurd rise to fame that Take That had. And they were all like, Robbie was 16 when he joined the band, and they were just thrown into nightclubs immediately with very little music behind them. And that the Take That time is portrayed in a brilliant medley of songs, not all Take That songs, and but mostly Take That covers due to kind of probably licensing. But then Robbie's solo songs are worked into this incredible medley, and it's one of the biggest showstoppers within the whole film. But a very interesting thing that has happened is in interviews with Robbie, he said that Gary isn't very happy with how he's been portrayed in the film, but Robbie reassured him that nobody comes off worse in the film about Robbie Williams than Robbie Williams.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's decided to let himself be portrayed with this CGI monkey. And it does talk a little bit, I mean, it touches a little bit. Certainly the interview I saw between Gracie and Robbie Williams, you did get the sense that what Robbie Williams wanted to portray here was just how difficult it was. I mean, the level of fame that was achieved so quickly and how to handle that as essentially a teenager and the difficulties that it led to within his life, namely the performing a monkey aspect of things.
Yeah, Robbie has always been very open about the pressure that he's felt from fame. He was asked to leave Take That because he was not coping with the pressure of being so famous, and he turned to drink and drugs as a coping mechanism. And that didn't leave when he became famous as a solo act, and he became much, far more famous than Take That ever were, far more successful, and those problems then escalated. But it is very interesting in the way that he deals with fame, because I think the monkey was used in a way to let him display just how terrible his actions were when he was under the influence and how much he hurt people. Nicole Appleton from the All Saints is portrayed in this as well, and he was engaged.
Rochelle Bano playing that part.
He was engaged to her for a number of years, and while there has been some stories that were made public about their relationship, when you see how badly he treated her in moments of pure kind of addiction and self-loathing, it's quite shocking, and this film does feel like an apology towards her.
I was going to say, is there a sense at which he's holding up his hands here and saying, look, I did some bad things, let me show you them?
Exactly, that's well and truly what he's doing here. Mm. And
did that endear you to him?
It did, because I feel, again, with the monkey, if there was an actor whose face was being kind of attached to the Robbie name, it would be very hard to kind of get on board with the story. But when you are looking at an ape, it sounds so ridiculous, but you do soften to the difficulties when you see just how alone he was and how he felt it was like him against the world, and he just had to keep at it.
There's a Parkinson moment, there's a Parky moment in here as well, isn't there? Yeah,
there's a lot of big recreations of famous moments, like the Parkinson interview.
The Gallagher brothers? The
Gallagher brothers make an appearance as well. Hilarious, and the outfits that he wears as well. I think a lot of people might be familiar. When Robbie left Take That, he went to Glastonbury wearing a football kit, and that was when he was meant to be hanging out with the Gallagher brothers, and that's in the movie as well. Tom Jones also makes an appearance. It's fantastic. It's a real...
And these are actors playing those parts.
Playing these roles, but it's a real kind of look over of pop... the pop time frame of the 90s and the 2000s, which he dominated.
And given that you're saying that he does hold up his hands, or it seems as if he is holding up his hands here and apologising in many ways through this film for things that he's not proud of, is it warts and all? Or is there anything that's slipped over and not really dealt with?
Well, the film only goes up to 2003. So we don't get any of the Take That reunion. We don't get anything kind of after that point. We just don't know there... It is interesting to know why he stopped at that point, especially when he did release a documentary series with Netflix earlier on this year, which was 4 hours long. And there was a lot of information there that just didn't make it into the film, but it had to be turned into something interesting. And while it is quite long, it's an hour and a half before we even touch Angels. And there was still 40 minutes left in that film then at that point, which is too long.
So is that your major criticism of it? Too long?
Honestly, yeah, probably. And when I went to the screening, a lot of people were saying this is one of the movies of the year. And I don't want to set people's expectations too high. It is probably the most surprising movie of the year.
And it has that epic scale of The Greatest Showman on Earth. Because I mean, there's 1.1 clip that I saw. The entire street is full of the entire neighbourhood dancing and singing.
It is a full musical number on Regent Street. And a lot of his songs get a lease of life that we probably would not have given them otherwise.
All right. It's on it's in cinemas from December 26th. Now, there's another one to add to your Christmas cinema list, potentially. That is Robbie. And it's simply called A Better Man. Louise Bruton telling us about that there. Let me briefly, before I go, tell you about the Irish Book Awards grand finale on TV tonight, RTE1 at 10:15 p.m. Oliver Callan will present the hour-long special in which 6 books compete for the overall accolade of Unpussed Irish Book of the Year. Heart Be at Peace by Donal Ryan, Eastern Novel of the Year. Fionn and the Last Snow Deer by Eilish Fisher, Dermot Flynn, Specsavers Children's Book. Frankie by Graham Norton, the Ireland AM Popular Fiction winner. A Stranger in the Family by Jane Casey, the Irish independent crime fiction book. Obsessed, the autobiography by Johnny Sexton with Peter O'Reilly, the Eastern Sport Book of the Year. And last but by no means least, Nature Joy, A Journey of Birdsong, Belonging and Belonging by Sean Renan. And that's the Debray biography of the year. We will find out tonight which one of those is the winner of the Unpussed Irish Book of the Year 2024, RTÉ1 Television, 10:15 p.m. this evening. That's our lot for this Thursday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.